You wanted to design the swivel parts, and the only way to do it was a major job to fix the mold. Well, the engineer says, run them the way they are, and if there are any rejects, we'll take care of them. And I did, and he had much fewer rejects than with his other supplier. But then he sends me a credit for the parts broken. And I went back to him and I said, this wasn't our agreement. He says, I don't care, you ship me junk. Well, I said, up your tootsie, I'll take the credit, take your molds. And the owner of the company called me, come down and see me, which I did. And he asked me to stay on. I told him that, number one, I don't think this is a great item, great brain. And number two, I can't deal with people like this. I mean, I have to deal with integrity. If you say something, I don't have to have it written down. Your word is good for me, but I can't deal that way. So I gave it up. And of course, it became one of the largest molding jobs in the country for years. That was a less than intelligent experience, but still I would have done the same thing. Because in business, you have to have trust with the people you deal with, and if you don't have it, forget it.
And just start over again.
Right after World War II, they decided to train soldiers because the whole army left. And to shoot a mortar, if you have the right inclination but the wrong direction, it's not going to go where you want it to go. And they would kill quite a few GIs or wound them, and it didn't bother them, till one general got blown out of his jeep. And then they decided to have a safe training procedures. An anchor something or other, I'll look up the word later, got a contract for the pistol, the rifle, and the mortar to develop safe training procedures. They gave us the job to develop the whole thing. And we had a certain limitation. He had left over a very precise bore ID of 1 inch. We had a lot of those tubes, so he wanted us to use those up. And it had to be reusable. We knew nothing about firing mortars, so he, the owner, was a major in the reserve. He took me down to the firing range. I learned how they shoot mortars. I got all the tables and so on. And to make a very long story short, we came up with a system where when you drop the mortar in, it hits an air valve and it shoots out. And then they wanted it to look like a mortar, so we had to explode a blank, 22 blank. And we couldn't explode the blank in the plastic because eventually the plastic would go. So we had to encapsulate a inner liner in the plastic with a thread on it to hold the nose cone. We made handmade samples and found the plastic was too light, so we added a metal nose cone to give it a trajectory. And we had a whole lot of problems. There's an article I gave you which you could take from to solve it. And we finally solved it. We figured we could hit a radius of a diameter of 10 feet 99% of the time. So we set the standards of a diameter of 40 feet. So we were never out there. Though they could put the took a jerry can about foot by foot, and they could most of the time get right into the can. But we shot the plastic out, and the contracting officer says, plastic is no good, it's not going to last, make it out of aluminum. I was smart enough to argue, so we made an aluminum piece. We made two aluminum pieces. One aluminum piece we banged out so that it would not fit back into the shaft. And then we went down there, and what you'd do is you'd shoot it and a guy would run out and bring it back. So we shot the plastic, worked beautifully, shot the aluminum, worked beautifully. Guy switches the aluminum one, the colonel couldn't get the major, couldn't get the tube into the missile into the tube because it had a big dent. And we had a clearance of about a half a thousandth. So my guy, this was all set up, says, why don't you use plastic? He says, here, I have a bad one which we got in testing when it hit a rock, and he takes out a bayonet and he shaves it off and drops it in. Well, the major said that it's okay, we'll use plastic.
That sounded a little underhanded, wasn't it?
Very underhanded. But, you know, the guy, I couldn't educate the guy because to them plastics is no good. You know, this goes back a long time, in the late 1940s. And there's an article and illustrations from which you can get more. Another one of our custom molded things was also of significance. I was in my office and a man comes in and he's molding plastic parts for vacuum cleaners, nozzles, connectors, brushes, and so on. And he's having it done in Cleveland, and he's very unhappy with that because he can't get delivery, the part's no good, cha-cha-cha-cha. And he had a shot. The shot is the plastic parts with the runners attached to the runners. And I immediately saw what was wrong, and he asked me to quote, which I did, which turned out to be half the price of the guy he was getting it from in Cleveland, plus the shipping, which wouldn't be important. And he said, go ahead. And he shipped the mold in to me. His name was Marty Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, and he was the owner of Craft Tool. They make shop vac, S-H-O-P-V-A-C, suction devices, like vacuum cleaners, for a shop for your house, the biggest in the world. And I asked him how he came to me, and we both bought drill presses from the same company. And we were all very close to each other. And when he told the owner of the company from which he bought the machinery his problem, the owner said, why don't you go to Reuben? He's within walking distance, and that's how he came over. And that ended up probably to be as big a customer as we ever had. We molded an incredible number of parts. He and I got along together famously. He was an art connoisseur, a man of great learning, a philosopher, and we would have a great time. And we would sit and design things in plastic. He would tell me what he wants. He was an artist, so he could sketch as well. And we developed an awful lot of parts. And ultimately, when I sold my molding plant, I still molded for him, but ultimately, he either went into his own molding or got lower prices. And I know in one instance, well, I better not put this down because the company's still very big and in existence. Another thing that we did was one of the people, one of the companies, Angelo, who sold our lamp parts, was huge in switch plates, and he was having them made overseas. And the problem was he would be out of stock all the time, and for a parts distributor to have to restock or reship with all the paperwork and dissatisfaction was a disaster. So he took his best-selling ones and he had me build molds for them. And we produced an awful lot of nameplates. Now, one of the problems he had in nameplates was if you put it in the kitchen or the bathroom, you used products which had enough grease in your hand to get the hot stamping off, particularly in the kitchen. So I came up with an idea which was not really new, but I had never heard of it. I took a foil that was pre-printed on rolls, and I took the foil, the roll of foil, on top of the press, and then I pulled it down so that the color, the imprint we wanted was directly over the mold, closed the machine and molded over it. So we had a switch plate which had the material, the colored material covered by the plastic. And then it would move down again, and I used a photoelectric cell with a black spot to locate it. And we made huge numbers of parts like that. Matter of fact, any decoration was really cheaper to do that way because you didn't have to do anything afterwards, even though the foil was more expensive. Another one, which was a probably as large as Craft Tool, was for Galton Industries, G-U-L-T-O-N. They had, the old man Galton, had the patent for NiCad batteries. And how did he get it? He and Rothberg, that's the man for whom I worked when we made tricresyl phosphate, developed NiCad batteries together. And Rothberg made the great decision of his life, he sold them half the patent. I didn't know this. I mean, I found out later, but I didn't know this in the beginning. After Robinson left, and I had the whole business to myself, I needed more security, so I called in two people, one an efficiency expert, which helped me a lot, and then I saw an ad in the New York Times on Sunday. Marketing manager for South American Home Products has 1 week to spare. for $100, you'll get $1,000 in return. Call Monday morning. So I called him Sunday night. And I met him Monday morning, gave him $100, came back a week later with a list of about 30 people to see, the top one first. And the top one was Galton Industries in Metuchen, New Jersey. And I went, I called up the purchasing agent, and he said, come on down. I said, when? He said, when do you want to come? I said, how about tomorrow morning? He said, fine. I said, I'll be there at 9 o'clock. He said, I'll wait for you. In those days, there was no Verrazano Bridge, so you had to go through New York, the Holland Tunnel. I got there about 9:15, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 11:45, he comes out. The whole office is filled with people he had appointments with or wanted to see him. He says, can't make it today, come back to another time. So I got up. I said, you're a miserable bastard. I said, everybody here makes their living with their time, and you have the guts to come out and say a thing like that? He said, you must be a boss. I said, you're damn well right I am. That doesn't give you the right to do it. So he apologized, and he pulled me aside, and he said, the Dr. Galton had pulled him in, and he couldn't get out with a message, which is a lot of nonsense. And he gave me an appointment with the vice president in charge of the whole plant. I met with him. He was, next day, he was a fellow graduate of City College. We got along beautifully. And at that time, Galton wanted to sell his stock. So he was making parts that were consumer, like rechargeable cigarette lighters and stuff like that. He did very well with it. And I did very well with the parts, and then they decided to go into batteries for, NiCad batteries, for the space program and for ships and for gardening equipment and so on. And they gave it out to me and to another company. The requirement was very tight fit between the cover and the case. Now the case might be, say, 4 inches by an inch by 10 inches, and the cover was a very small part that fit in. And the real problem they had was, unless they had a line-to-line fit, the solvent, phenol, which they used to cement the cover to the top, and it had to be a good cement job because you generate gas. If you don't have the top on, you'll just blow the top off the battery. But if a drop of phenol got onto the plates were no good. And plates could cost anywhere from $50 to $20,000, you know, the bigger ones. I knew that I could not do it with two separate molds. So I built one mold, which had a cover and a case, and we adjusted the fit so that when it's soft, you could put it in, but when it struck, you couldn't pull it out by hand. And the way they used it was they held the bottom part, the container, in a hydraulic, pneumatic setup. They pulled up the top hydraulically, they screwed on the battery with two screws, they had an automatic applier for the phenol, they shoved it right back in. They never lost one battery because of the fit. And they had a lot of other things. The technical problem there was nobody thought you could mold two different weights, or very different weights, might be a difference of 20 times on the same mold. But without getting technical, if you really understood the process, you could. My competitor, he had a two-cavity mold for the container and a two-cavity mold for the cover, so his mold costs were double. And he had 16 girls trying to get good fits, and they never did. So immediately I became the preferred supplier. Now I had a deal with every one of the people I dealt with. If you make a small mistake, forget it, we'll pay for it. It's in your price. But if you wanted 1 inch and you wrote 20 inches, that of course you couldn't do. So they never would have to go back to the boss for $100 here, $500 there, and so on. And I said, if there's a mistake made, we made it. But let them holler at us. The worst we can do is lose a customer, you can lose a job. So we always had the goodwill of the people, the engineers we dealt with. And Tom Dowling was his name, D-O-W-L-I-N-G, great guy, told us what was happening with the other guy. Their parts were ruining the plates. So as I got more of their jobs, because they were expanding, my price went way, way up. And Bernie Herman, that's the vice president, spoke to Galton. And Galton invited me in, and I got to know him very well, especially when I found out he knew Pincus Rothberg. We got so much business, I wanted to give him a present. He was Jewish. I said, let me build you your own private bathroom. He always went to the office bathroom? He says, no. I said, tell me why. He says, I learn more about my company when I sit in the stall than I ever learn anywhere else. But it was a great time. And we kept on raising our prices. Because you have a monopoly, you do it. Finally, the old man calls me and he says, enough. He said, genug. He was German-born, enough. So I said, okay. Then we had a disaster. We were making a cigar lighter, rechargeable. And I realized too late the mold was not going to work. Okay. So just then they get a new purchasing agent. Now who was this purchasing agent? He was a former purchasing agent for Emerson Electric. And when I was with Danny Lewis and RLR, they had a show coming up with a tape recorder. And they wanted us to make, in no time flat, a container for it. A very difficult reverse forming job. We stayed up literally two nights. And our agreement was, we'll just make the box, you put in all the holes. Because we didn't know where the holes were and we didn't have the time. Bleary eye, we come in 10 o'clock in the morning on time, put it there, he says, beautiful, where the hell are the holes? I said, you agreed to do it. He says, I don't have time to do it, you do it. I said, we don't have time either. Now, if you want it, you have it. If you don't want it, no. He says, I won't accept it without the holes. He figured we'd do the holes. So Danny and I walked out. There was a New York City garbage truck there, picking up garbage. We looked at each other and we tossed the thing into the garbage truck. The president of Emerson called up, wanting us, it was a big line, they had no container. We told him, no way, we don't deal with companies like that. This was a new purchasing agent, where I'm stuck here with a mold that doesn't work. And he knew about it, I told him. So he said he found a molder, and there's a conference with the old man Galton, that for $3,000 would fix it up. I said to him, I don't want to mention his name, if I give you the $3,000, I'm relieved of all responsibility. He said, certainly. So I took out a check, wrote out a check for $3,000. I expected to get all heck from Dr. Galton. He says to the purchasing agent, he says, you keep him. He is a guy who keeps his word. He makes a mistake and he's willing to pay for it. And he pats me on the back and walks out. I thought the purchasing agent was going to plots. But ultimately they moved to Valdosta, Georgia, because Galton sold it to SAFT, S-A-F-T, the largest battery manufacturer in Europe. And you can't operate, first of all, 3 days to get there and back. And I was the only supplier who visited them there. And you can't really transplant. They wanted the people to speak French. So they left me for an hour for these guys from New York, New Jersey. They don't give a damn about speaking French. So it never worked that well for them. And they eventually got out of it. They didn't get out of it, but they eventually got it to work. And the owner of the company came there to visit when I was there once. So he invited me out for lunch. And I got introduced to him. And with everybody around, I said, parlez-vous francaise? And he answers, oui. And everybody there died. But he understood what I was doing. So we had a long talk, and I told him that it's much better for you Frenchmen to learn English than to try and teach Yankees to speak a foreign language. It's not going to work. So we changed it. And we became fairly friendly. Whenever he came down, I would come down. But after about 2 years, I told him I'm going to show another molder how to make battery cases and take all the business down there because I can't handle it. And that's what happened. And I would still consult for them from time to time.
Mr. Rubin, you've given us a very interesting overview of your business career, including examples of your business acumen and your business philosophy in dealing with other business persons. As you look back over your career, what would you pick out as being, in your estimation, your chief contribution to the development of the plastic industry?
I was honored by being elected to the Plastic Hall of Fame a number of years ago. There are 32 living members in the whole plastic community worldwide, which is a very distinguished honor, the highest honor you can get in the plastic industry. And I never understood when a Nobel Prize winner was awoken in the middle of the night by newspapers to tell him he won the prize, that he asked for what. because you don't win a Nobel Prize unless you've done something that's absolutely worldwide recognized of major importance. But on a much, 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 much lower level, when I was told that I was going to be inducted to the Hall of Fame, I didn't really understand why for a long time, because what you really do is you're doing the same thing every day. You have the same face in the mirror when you shave, whatever you do. But after about 8 or 9 years of thinking and asking people, I think the most important thing that I did was I established a theory of injection molding based on scientific principles. Before, it was a black box operation. You tried this, you tried that, and by experience you know that if it didn't fill out, you gave it more material. But you never understood why. And I was able to do that in my book, in my lectures, and the rippling effect of it. For example, as I mentioned, correcting molding faults, or the mold list, or the design information. This spread out worldwide in the plastic industry. That, I would say, that was my major, a major contribution. Secondly, in my lecturing, I did a lot of lecturing for SPE, for plastic seminars, for other people, and literally thousands of students have gone through my courses, and I have many, many letters telling me how much they've helped, and I always would make the statement that if I could help you very easily on the phone or looking at a part, I would do it no charge. And to this day, I have stopped lecturing a year or two ago. I still get a call or two a week from people that I've done. I also think a major contribution was with Dr. Kaufman setting up the seminar series. There were no seminar series in any industry that we knew of at the time. And this goes back to the early 60s, maybe late 50s, something like that, which has proliferated worldwide now. Another thing that I did, where I was before my time, was Lou Natterman, the person that rewrote my book for me, edited it. We decided that we ought to take our lectures and put them on tape. So the only thing available then was half a one-inch tape. I'd have to check that out. And we started a company, Visual Learning, where we put these things on tape. But the real problem was that nobody had machines. The VCR was not invented yet, or if it was invented, wasn't being sold. And we did all right with it, but incidentally, an interesting thing is our major customers, we thought would be manufacturers, it turned out to be prisons. So the huge number to prisons, because in the plastic industry, you wanted to work, go work. We didn't give a damn what you did. So the prison industry found that out and trained their prisoners, and some of them did very well.
Did they, when they left prison, did they find employment in the plastic industry?
100%.
So was
to it, my, when I say 100% to my knowledge.
Yeah, yeah, so it was a very effective rehabilitation program.
Yeah, because the trouble is they have to get a job, if not they're going to become criminals. And some of them were really smart, some of them were not, but you didn't need much brains to run a molding machine. Another thing was in vacuum metallizing. The plant that Danny Lewis and I built was one of the first plants in New York City. And when I knew something about forming, as I said, at Columbia, I played around with it. And when I built the machines, it never occurred to me not to make them automatic. And I think the first automatic injection vacuum forming machine, where all you had to do was put the part in, everything else went, and then he could be cutting or doing something else. I think I was one who designed it and built it. We built all our equipment. I built all the equipment. We had a machine shop in-house. Another thing that was an accomplishment was the whole way of internal carving. Another thing was the vacuum metallizing. We were the ones who brought it into plastic. And I think we were the ones, the two people in vacuum metallizing and I, who really developed the process for plastic. I mean, the process was there, but it was not applicable to plastic. Matter of fact, at that time, they just used it for throwaways. Of course, they couldn't keep the plastic coating on it. And we did a lot of interesting work in medical field, developing medical items with customers. And then finally, I'm an activist. In New York, they would have these one-minute bites where people would get up and say their mind. And if you wanted a rebuttal, you could do it. And at that time, Nassau County was trying to ban styrofoam cups because they had a problem with the landfill. And it really got me. So I wrote him a letter saying that if plastic cups never existed, you still would have the same problem with your landfill. And I made a number of suggestions how we could solve this problem. And they had me on the air to give a one-minute, they let me go for two-minute rebuttal, and they would have programs on plastic, half-hour interview programs, and I was involved in a lot, not a lot, but a number of those. One, for example, a woman who I found out later was an actress employed by the glass, the paper cup industry, against styrofoam cups, and she made all kinds of absurd statements like, styrofoam on the ground, little kids go eating it. And I said, I got children and grandchildren. I said, I never saw a kid chase a styrofoam cup pellet, but I said, you live in a much higher circle than I. And things like that. And any time I saw something incorrect, like in Business Week or the Times or so on, I would write appropriate letters and get results.
You have made reference briefly to family members on the way. Tell me something more about your family.
Okay. I'll start with my father. Two of his brothers came about the same time he did. One was a partner in, with him in business, and they're both gone. One of his sisters was married because there were a Jewish doctor in Sweden was looking for a Jewish woman, and the matchmaker suggested that he go to visit my father's family, and he went, and they got married and moved to Sweden. And they're the only members of the family left alive. The Germans killed them all. So I know very little about him, and I sincerely regret it. That's one of the things that led me to the history project about which I'd like to talk in a moment. My mother's side came from hundreds of years of really distinguished scholars. For example, my grandmother's first cousin, obviously my cousin, was put on the dollar American stamp. Now, you don't get put on an American stamp. He was the founder of Yeshiva University. And he would visit my grandmother and my mother very often with his two sons, one who could always beat me in chess, the other I could always beat in chess. One day he asked me, why don't I become, I was about 6 years old at the time, would I like to become a rabbi? And I said, no. He said, why? I said, you don't make enough money. And on the other side, the distinguished scholars that go, well, I don't want to name them, go all the way back. And we were, my father always made a living, but just by the skin of his teeth. So we were able to have the usual amenities of a middle, lower middle class family. They still had enough money to send me to camp sometime. And but I learned the value of saving. I remember my parents vividly, they'd walk with two huge paper bags, five extra blocks because they could save a few cents on groceries. And my father, by the way, was a great wrestling fan, and he didn't ride on the Sabbath. So we'd walk about 2 miles further into Brooklyn. He had bought the seats beforehand to watch wrestling in an arena. And it was a very good childhood. Saturday morning, my father would go to the synagogue, and before I was old enough, he took me when I was about five, and after lunch, he would read to me from Swiss Family Robinson, Treasure Island, but after 10 minutes, he'd fall asleep. So I complained to my mother, and she said, learn how to read. So at five, I was reading Swiss Family Robinson and books like that. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was very easy. Well, my mother was a great teacher. She, if I came home with a 99 average, she said, that's terrible. Did you get 100? And she was right. And there was always the push for excellence. You do the best you can. And for my grandmother, who was a brilliant woman, she later moved to our apartment house on the same floor. She could read, write, and speak seven different languages. And she would talk to me. I couldn't talk to my mother. But, for example, we were talking about America, and she said what makes America great are two things, freedom and the ability to make and keep money. And I could spend a long time about the things Not only that, I once complained to her that I had trouble kissing girls. Must have been about 17 at the time. She says, how do you go about it? And I told her. She said, that's the wrong way. She says, you don't go for the body, you go for the head. You make the girl like you, tell her the nice things you can think about her, and the rest will be easy. She was right.
You experimented and found out.
Well, yeah, but it took a long time. But she had a great library. She had some original books of Shakespeare. She read them all and so on. Great lady. My mother lived to be about 101, just a month short of it. And she lived alone until she was about 96, and then she got forgetful. And we put her to a senior living home, and then ultimately her memory went, and she didn't want to live anymore, because she couldn't remember the end of the beginning of a program on TV by the time the end came. So she decided she didn't want to live, and she just died.